We are still in Samuel. Last week we finished chapter 16, where Absalom has set himself up as the king and has run his dad out of town. David has left some trusted people behind, and we'll see what they do tonight. And one of the reasons David left instead of making a fight of it there is he doesn't want to have a siege in the capital city. Furthermore, being in a walled city limits his maneuver. If Absalom surrounds Jerusalem, then he doesn't have the opportunity to send messages and stuff to the rest of the tribes and maybe rally some support. So he leaves. And as I said last time, Nathan, when he upbraided David in God's name, said that God put a curse on him. And that curse was, I will raise trouble for you in your own house, and somebody will sleep with your wives, just like you slept with Uriah's wife, and they'll do it right out in public. God says this in the form of, this is something I will do. It's not a prophecy per se, it is something that God has promised is going to happen. The fact that it's in the future, you can look at it as a prophecy. But the first part of the problem was the rape of Tamar by Amnon, and then Absalom killed Amnon. And Absalom, I am convinced, is angry still with his father, because his father, first off, didn't prevent the business with Tamar, and second, didn't do anything to Amnon after the fact. So the fact that Absalom is setting out deliberately to kill his own father, certainly it's I want to be a king movement, that's very obvious, but I think it's also animus that dad didn't do anything about the problem that we had in the family here. David left some trusted advisors behind and headed out. I've got a map behind me on the board, and for those of you out in streaming land, you can get this map or any other map, for example, on the internet. But what I want you to see is where Jerusalem is, and it's at the bottom center of this map. And David takes off from Jerusalem, goes down this route to Jericho, crosses the Jordan River. I don't know whether he goes up the west side of the east side of the Jordan, but he fetches up here at Mahanaim. And as I said before, Mahanaim is a notorious place. It is the place where Jacob met Esau. So when Jacob was coming back from Haran and sent ahead to his brother that says, I'm coming back, Mahanaim is where all that took place. Similarly, as you remember from earlier in 2 Samuel here, when Saul and Jonathan were killed in battle, then his remaining son, Ishbosheth, also goes to Mahanaim. And the thing about Mahanaim is it's a canyon, and it's really rough, rugged country. So if somebody is coming after you, it's very defensible. And as we're going to see tonight, the forest of Ephraim is north of Mahanaim, and that forest is so thick that during the battle that happens, lots of people just get lost in the forest because it's so thick. So if you're running and hiding and you're not sure of your situation, Mahanaim is a really good place to go. So chapter 17. Moreover, Ahithophel said to Absalom, let me choose 12,000 men, and I will arise and pursue David tonight. I will come upon him while he is weary and discouraged, and throw him into a panic. And all the people who are with him will flee. I will strike down only the king, and I will bring all the people back to you as a bride comes home to her husband. You seek the life of only one man, and all the people will be at peace. And the advice seemed right in the eyes of Absalom and all the elders of Israel. As I said last time, and I've said several times, Ahithophel, who was one of David's oldest and most trusted advisor, has gone with his son to rout him out. And scripture does not say this, but I firmly believe that Ahithophel was appalled at David taking Bathsheba and killing Uriah, because Ahithophel is Bathsheba's grandfather. Uriah would have been his grandson-in-law, and I don't think Ahithophel ever forgave David. So when the opportunity arose, he went the other way. And his advice, by the way, is excellent, because David is on the run, and he, at this point in his flight, has not yet crossed the Jordan River. He is vulnerable. His people have been running all day. They are not set up for battle. So the idea of catching him still while he's out in the open is excellent advice. So verse 5. Then Absalom said, "Call Hushai, the Archite also, and let us hear what he has to say." Now, Hushai, of course, is another of David's most trusted advisors, and Hushai is David's man. You remember Hushai was trying to get into David's party and flee with David, and David said, "No, I want you to go back, and I want you to say, 'Long live the king,' and I want you to cozy up to Absalom and let me know what's going on." Verse 6. When Hushai came to Absalom, Absalom said to him, "Thus has Ahithophel spoken. Shall we do as he says? If not, you speak." Then Hushai said to Absalom, "This time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Notice "this time," because as we saw in a previous chapter, the words of Ahithophel were as if you had inquired of God himself. So "this time" is sort of a respectful, normally Ahithophel would be right on the beam, but this time he's not quite right. "So this time the counsel that Ahithophel has given is not good." Hushai said, "You know that your father and his men are mighty men, and that they are enraged, like a bear robbed of her cubs in the field. Besides, your father is expert in war. He will not spend the night with the people. Behold, even now he has hidden himself in one of the pits or some other place. And as soon as some of the people fall at the first attack, whoever hears will say, 'There's been a slaughter among the people who follow Absalom.' Then even the valiant men, whose heart is like the heart of a lion, will utterly melt with fear. For all Israel knows that your father is a mighty man, and those who are with him are valiant men." So Ahithophel's advice, according to Hushai, is not good. Hushai's advice is, "Your dad has been doing this a long time. This is not his first rodeo. There's no way that he is going to travel with a pack of refugees. He's going to go off someplace and hide. And what's going to happen is your party is going to fall on the refugees, and there's going to be a fight. And the fight will not take out your father, but it will slaughter a bunch of people. And everybody is then going to say, 'Oh, we have a civil war now.' And so your reputation will suffer." Verse 11. "But my counsel is that all Israel be gathered to you from Dan to Beersheba, as the sand by the sea for multitude, and that you go to battle in person." So what he's now doing is he's appealing to the young man, "You lead this expedition personally. You be the one out in front with all the flags and all that kind of stuff. And oh, by the way, wait until you've got all of Israel behind you, so you have overwhelming force. Take your time, get this organized, you lead it yourself. It'll be more sure of success." That's his advice. Verse 12. "So we shall come upon him in some place where he is to be found, and we shall light upon him as the dew falls on the ground, and of him and all his men with him, not one will be left. If he withdraws into a city, then all Israel will bring ropes to that city, and we shall drag it into the valley, until not even a pebble has to be found there." And Absalom and all the men of Israel said, "The counsel of Hushai, the Archite, is better than the counsel of Ahithophel. For the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel, so that the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom." Just an aside for a minute. where it says the Lord had ordained to defeat the good counsel of Ahithophel so the Lord might bring harm upon Absalom. There's no prophet involved here. This is written after the fact as a history. David's going to win. And so the business of the Lord says may or may not have been anything except the notation of a scribe here who was writing down a history. Because as I say, there isn't a prophet here that is speaking. And people being how they are, they will pad the account to make the winners look good. I don't know that that's true. I'm just saying that that would be something that would not surprise me a bit. Verse 15. Then Hushai said to Zadok and Abiathar the priest, thus and so did Ahithophel counsel Absalom and the elders of Israel. And thus so I have counseled. Now therefore, send quickly and tell David, do not stay at the fords of the wilderness, but by all means pass over, lest the king and all the people who are with him be swallowed up. Remember, Hushai, Zadok, and Abiathar are all David's men. Furthermore, the sons of Zadok and Abiathar are in Enrogel, which is about a mile or two to the south and east of Jerusalem. And they're waiting for word from Zadok and Abiathar, and they're going to be runners to take that word to David. This is all set up and arranged. So Hushai is letting Zadok and Abiathar know what's going on and having them send a message to David. And the counsel is, make sure that you are not out in the open where they can catch you. Get to someplace safe. Don't stop now. Verse 17. Now Jonathan and Ahimaaz were waiting at Enrogel. A female servant was to go and tell them. And they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. You have a female servant, you know, sort of Audrey Hepburn. You all know the story of Audrey Hepburn? Very, very famous movie actress. During World War II, she was a teenage girl in Holland, and she was running messages to the resistance back and forth. No, just this little innocent teenage girl riding her bike, and she's carrying messages back and forth through the resistance. So this little female servant is doing the same thing. Obviously, Zadok and Abiathar can't go out to talk to their sons because they'll be seen. And similarly, their sons can't come in because they'll be seen. So a female servant was to go and tell them, and they were to go and tell King David, for they were not to be seen entering the city. But a young man saw them and told Absalom. So they've been spotted. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man, Bahurim. Now, Bahurim is Nob by another name. And you remember Nob is where the priests lived. Both of them are on the trail down to Jericho. So they get the message at Enrogel, and then they realize they've been ratted out. So they run to Nob, and that's where they're going to hide out until the pursuit calms down. So both of them went away quickly and came to the house of a man at Bahurim, who had a well in his courtyard, and they went down into it. And the woman took and spread a covering over the well's mouth and scattered grain on it. Nothing was known of it. When Absalom's servants came to the woman of the house, they said, where are Ahimaaz and Jonathan? And the woman said to them, they have gone over the brook of water. And when they had sought them and could not find them, they returned to Jerusalem. This is, you know, very much reminiscent of the spies being hidden when Joshua was entering the land. 21. After they had gone, the men came out of the well and went and told King David. They said to David, arise and go quickly over the water, for thus and so has Ahithophel counseled against you. Then David arose and all the people who were with him, and they crossed the Jordan. By daybreak, no one was left who had not crossed the Jordan. So they had been traveling all night. When Ahithophel saw that his counsel was not followed, he saddled his donkey, went off home to his own city. He set his house in order and hanged himself. And he died and was buried in the tomb of his father. It is not that he is in a fit of pique, that nobody listened to him. He knows that unless his counsel is followed, David is probably going to win. And when David wins and comes back, he is not going to be pleased with Ahithophel. So Ahithophel realizes that the course of action that is going to be taken, as recommended by Hushai, is going to lead to the defeat of the rebellion. So he says, it's all over, and goes home and gets things organized and has a quiet, dignified death. And the other part of that, and David wouldn't have done it, but he doesn't know that. It's entirely possible that David will take him and his entire family out. You know, when it says, yeah, I'll go biblical on you, that's the kind of stuff we're talking about. Now, as we're going to see, when David finally prevails, he is going to be very magnanimous in victory. But Ahithophel doesn't know that. So he hangs himself to avoid what he knows is going to happen. 24. Then David came to Mahanaim, and Absalom crossed the Jordan with all the men of Israel. Now Absalom had set Amasa over the army instead of Joab. Amasa was the son of a man named Ithra, the Ishmaelite, who had married Abigail, the daughter of Nahash, sister of Zariah, Joab's mother. As you want to unpack that, what he is Joab's cousin. Zariah is Joab's mother. Nahash is Joab's uncle. He has married Abigail, who's the daughter of Joab's uncle, so he is a cousin by marriage. He's also an Ishmaelite. 26. And Israel and Absalom encamped in the land of Gilead. When David came to Mahanaim, Shobai, the son of Nahash, from Obah of the Ammonites, and Machir, the son of Amiel, from Lodebar, and Barzillai, the Gileadite, from Roglem, brought beds, basins, earthen vessels, wheat, barley, flour, parched grain, beans, and lentils, honey and curds, and sheep and cheese from the herd, for David and the people who were with him to eat. For they said, the people are hungry and weary and thirsty in the wilderness. This is one of the reasons that David did not want to stay in Jerusalem. Because if Jerusalem's under siege, none of these people are going to be able to get to him. He's not going to get any food, reinforcements, or anything because they won't be able to get through the siege. And it'll just be a great big mess. So by being out there, the people who are still loyal to him find a way to get to him, to sustain him and, you know, join up with him because he'll have lots of troops with him. So again, that's the reason why he chose not to stay and fight, but instead to run. Chapter 18. Then David mustered the men who were with him and set over them commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. Notice he has got more than 1,000 men with him. Commanders of thousands indicate that you got more than one. I don't know how many he does have, but it's quite a formidable army, especially since the nucleus of that army is his entire palace guard, who are composed of mighty men who have been with him ever since he was hiding out in Gath and so forth. So these are people who know what they're doing. Verse 2. And David sent out the army, one-third under the command of Joab, one-third under the command of Abishai, the son of Zariah, that's Joab's brother, and one-third under the command of Ittai, the Gittite. And the king said to the men, I myself will also go out with you. But the men said, you shall not go out. Now, David by this time is no spring chicken. He's still obviously crafty as a fox, but he is not in any condition anymore to be infantry. They know that, and so they say, no, you don't go with us. Because you were with us, you would be a liability. Because we'd have to have somebody guarding you, watching you, to prevent you from being taken, and we wouldn't be able to do what we need to do. They don't say it this way, but you'd be more of a hindrance than a help. So verse 3 again. But the men said, you shall not go out. For if we flee, they will not care about us. If half of us die, they will not care about us. But you are worth 10,000 of us. Therefore, it is better that you send us help from the city. So, very tactful way of saying, why don't you stay back here with the reserves, and if we need help, we'll send somebody and you can send reserves out to us. All very tactful and so forth. But at this point, David is not a young man anymore. Verse 4. The king said to them, "Whatever seems best to you, I will do." So the king stood at the side of the gate, while all the army marched out by hundreds and by thousands. And the king ordered Joab and Abishai and Ittai, "Deal gently for my sake with the young man Absalom." And all the people heard when the king gave orders to all his commanders about Absalom. In other words, go win this, but I would really rather you didn't kill my son. So the army went out into the field against Israel, and the battle was fought in the forest of Ephraim, and that's north of Mahanaim. Verse 7. And the men of Israel were defeated there by the servants of David, and the loss there was great on that day, 20,000 men. The battle spread over the face of all the country, and the forest devoured more people that day than the sword. So what you've got is a thick, treacherous forest, people getting lost, people getting injured, that kind of thing. Verse 9. And Absalom happened to meet the servants of David. Absalom was riding on his mule, and the mule went under the thick branches of a great oak, and his head was caught fast in the oak, and he was suspended between heaven and earth while the mule was under him and went on. Couple of things. You all remember from a couple chapters ago, Absalom is a very vain man. He cuts his hair once a year. And when he cuts his hair, he weighs it, further indication of vanity, and it typically weighs 5 pounds. So as he's fleeing with his hair flying in the wind, and obviously his hair got caught in some branches and jerked him off of his mule, and he's hanging there by his hair. And part of the problem is he's not in any position to do anything about it, other than perhaps take a knife or something and cut it off. The other thing to note is if Absalom, who is the commander of the army, is wandering around by himself, he is lost. He is no longer directing anything. His army goes into this battle in the forest of Ephraim. And by the way, forest of Ephraim is on the other side of the river from the territory of Ephraim. Ephraim just means fruitful. So it may not be a forest of the tribe of Ephraim. It may simply be a fruitful, thick forest. I'm just speculating here. But the fact that Absalom is alone and wandering around by himself indicates that things are not going well. Because the last thing you want is your king wandering around by himself in a battle. King should have a cadre of guards around him. A king should be in a position to give orders and direct the battle. He is doing neither of those things. Verse 10. And a certain man saw it and told Joab, "Behold, I saw Absalom hanging in an oak." Joab said to the man who told him, "What, you saw him? Why did you not strike him there to the ground? I would have been glad to give you 10 pieces of silver and a belt." But the man said to Joab, "Even if I felt in my hand the weight of 1,000 pieces of silver, I would not reach out my hand against the king's son. For in our hearing, the king commanded you and Abishai and Ittai, for my sake, protect the young man Absalom. On the other hand, if I had dealt treacherously against his life, and there is nothing hidden from the king, then you yourself would have stood aloof." In other words, big talk right now, saying if I had done it, you'd give me 10 pieces of silver. But I know darn good and well that if I actually had done it, you would have stood and said, "Oh, you violated the king's order." And I would have been struck down. In other words, this guy's not dumb either. Furthermore, he knows Joab. 14. Joab said, "I will not waste time like this with you. Talking to you is no use." And he took 3 javelins in his hand and thrust them into the heart of Absalom while he was still alive in the oak. And 10 young men, Joab's armor bearers, in other words, his personal cohort, surrounded Absalom and struck him and killed him. Then Joab blew the trumpet, and the troops came back from pursuing Israel, where Joab restrained them. Again, this is a good move on the part of Joab. He's taken out the leader of the rebellion. So at this point, what he doesn't want to do is have unnecessarily slaughter among the people of Israel, because what they're going to want to do is try and put the kingdom back together. If Joab does what he would do with the Ammonites or the Moabites or anybody like that and pursues them and slaughters them, it's going to leave a really bad taste in people's mouths, and reuniting the kingdom is going to be difficult. Verse 17. And they took Absalom and threw him into a great pit in the forest and raised over him a very great heap of stones. And all Israel fled, everyone to his own home. Now Absalom, in his lifetime, had taken and set up for himself the pillar that is in the king's valley. For he said, I have no son to keep my name in remembrance. He called the pillar after his own name, and it is called Absalom's Monument to this day. So they bury him in the forest. One of the things that you notice if you're paying attention to Israeli news is the bodies of IDF soldiers and Hamas terrorists are negotiating tools. So when the IDF kills a terrorist, they have his body. And that becomes something that they use to negotiate with to get either a prisoner back or something like that. So the other thing that we don't want to have happen here is Absalom's body to be useful to anybody. And the other thing that's interesting, I read this, I don't know how many times, just realized it. Another problem with Absalom being king is he doesn't have any sons. Now, he's a young enough man, and I am sure that he can get a half dozen concubines, and one of them ought to hit. But he may be the one that's the problem, and that's the other thing. Verse 19. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, Let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies. And Joab said to him, You are not to carry news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news, because the king's son is dead. What I suspect is going on here is Joab is protecting this young man, because David, in his grief, may do something rash. Now, he is the son of the high priest, so he's probably not in a great deal of danger, but I suspect that may have been going through Joab's mind. 21. Then Joab said to the Cushite, Go, tell the king what you have seen. The Cushite bowed before Joab and ran. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. And Joab said, Why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news? Come what may, he said, I will run. So he said to him, Run. Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. So his motivation is, you won. And he wants to be the first one to tell the king that you won and you're still the king now. Verse 24. Now David was sitting between the two gates, and the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, he saw a man running alone. The watchman called out and told the king. And the king said, If he is alone, there is news in his mouth. And he drew near and nearer, and the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gate and said, See, another man running alone. And the king said, He also brings news. The watchman said, I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, He is a good man, and he comes with good news. 28. Then Ahimaaz cried out to the king, All is well. And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. And the king said, Is it well with the young man Absalom? Ahimaaz answered, When Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, and I do not know what it was. And the king said, Turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood here. Interestingly, the Hillsdale College thing that I watched, talking about this passage, said what's going on is when David's only question is about his son, Ahimaaz, blip, and the thing he says is the Hebrew doesn't make any sense either. That's not what he was expecting to hear. He doesn't know what to say, and certainly he doesn't want to be the one to say that Absalom is dead. 31. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, Good news for my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rose up against you. The king said to the Cushite, Is it well with the young man Absalom? And the Cushite answered, "May the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man." And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. And as he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would I had died instead of you. Oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Several things going on here. One, of course, is David recognizes that this is all his own fault. These events were set in motion by the incident with Bathsheba. So he is full of remorse for the thing that has happened to his son because of his own behavior. And the other thing that is going on, of course, is he genuinely loves his son. So the combination of a father losing his son and the loss of his son being his own fault is just devastating. So chapter 19, it was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." So the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. So the whole army, instead of, "Wow, we got the little traitor," is now realizing that their victory is, in fact, something that is painful to the king. Verse 3, "And the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle." So instead of coming back in triumph and marching through the gates and saying, "We did it," they're slinking and sneaking back because they know that the king has no pleasure in what they have done. Verse 4, "The king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, 'Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son.' Then Joab came into the house of the king and said, 'You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life, and the lives of your sons and your daughters, and the lives of your wives and your concubines. Because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you, for you have made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead today, then you would be pleased." Strong message to follow. That's pretty straight, direct talk, especially to a king. Verse 7. "Now therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night. And this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." In other words, if you don't pull your socks up and start acting like a king, you're not going to be a king. That's the message. Verse 8. "Then the king arose and took his seat in the gate, and the people were all told, 'Behold, the king is sitting in the gate.' And all the people came before the king." So we'll stop there, because what we have next is the reconstruction of the kingdom as David goes back and starts putting things back together that have been destroyed. The comment was that there is this constant tension between David's role as king and David's role as father. And quite frankly, he doesn't do a very good job of balancing those things. David's an emotional guy. He wrote a great deal of the book of Psalms. He's a musician, he's a poet, very emotional, very charismatic. So the loss of his son, especially because he realizes it was his own doing that caused things to come to this point, just devastated him. So at the end of the paragraph here, he pulls up his socks, puts on his crown, and goes out and receives the army because he is still the king. It sort of reminds me of when the first child that Bathsheba had with him, he falls on his face and he mourns and he weeps and covers himself with ashes and all that kind of stuff. And then as soon as the child is dead, he gets up, washes his head, says, "Okay, fine." And his rationale is, while the child was still alive, it is possible that God might have changed his mind. God hasn't changed his mind. So fine, we'll move on. And the same thing is happening here. I'm mourning for my son, and it's my own fault. But when Joab finally says, "You either play the role of a father and go on weeping, or you start playing the role of a king, but you can't be both at this point. And you got to decide whether you want to be the king or whether you want to wallow in self-pity and sorrow. And he chooses to step up and be the king. It's David's personality, if you will, that we see all over the place in Scripture.